February 18th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. And members, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3615. And you have probably a summary in your file, but this bill is not actually, we don't have an amendment, so we don't have anything really to take up this morning. So I will then close the public hearing on House Bill 3615.
Close the public hearing.
It's the Rules Committee. What can I say? And we'll see how we do on our other votes. And I will then go to... Okay. I think I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3624. And Marjorie, could you please tell us about this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3624, the original bill, requires a person to provide proof of legal presence in the United States and a social security number before the DMV can issue, renew, or replace a driver's license, permit, or other identification card. The Dash 2 amendment, which is in your packet, replaces that measure and requires the Department of Transportation to report to the next legislative assembly on implementation of Senate Bill 1080. And the bill, the amendment also describes what to be included in that report.
And thank you, Marjorie. We have, it looks like, one witness signed up to testify, and that is Felisa Higgins. And Senator Metzger, I see you in the audience.
I'm just observing.
Great. Well, welcome to the role of observer.
You'll know as soon as we do, Senator.
Good morning and welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Felisa Higgins, and I'm here today representing the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. You'll see that the committee aide is handing out written testimony, so I'll be brief. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3624. We think it goes a long way into tracking the amendments, the Dash 2 amendments. It goes a long way into tracking some of the problems that are going to arise from Senate Bill 1080 and lays the groundwork for the legislature to make some changes in the future so that we can fix some of the outstanding problems that are in Senate Bill 1080. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, are there any questions for this witness?
Diane?
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Chair, thank you. When you say laying the groundwork for future changes, what kind of changes are you thinking?
I think that there are... I think that there are some issues that may arise with the implementation of Senate Bill 1080 around the timelines to get documentation, the help that the Arms Movement Program will provide, and other issues with folks falling off roles. The example that I use in the written testimony is I was reminded the other day regarding the Medicare study that DHS performed after U.S. citizenship was implemented into Medicare, that the large number of people who fell off the Medicare rolls were actually U.S. Citizens and legal residents. And so I think some of those issues may continue to arise with implementation of Senate Bill 1080. And so I think that we'll come back to the legislature after there's a tracking system to find out what problems do arise to make those changes. Does that answer your question?
Representative Thatcher, did you have another?
Oh, just one more question. Was there any discussion of looking at, I had heard rumblings, but I have never heard this session officially anybody speaking about the supposed two-tier license, where if you don't have documents, you can get a driver's card. Is that one of the options you're looking at?
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I would say that there are lots of options that can be explored in the 2009 session, and that would be one of those options. There is going to be issues that arise without people without having documentation around their identification. And so that's an issue that could be explored in 2009.
Okay, Representative Esquivel, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, and maybe I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that 44 other states have this requirement for a driver's license. It's a legal presence. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel, I believe that is correct.
Follow-up question. Instead of doing this, why don't we just ask the other states what's going on? Is that tough?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel, I believe that we should look to other states and see what problems that they've had arise before the implementation of Senate Bill 1080. However, during this legislative session, we decided to move forward with Senate Bill 1080, and so a possibility is to track the changes that arise here in our state, in Oregon, as we implement this bill, which the Dash 2 amendments do. And then I think some outreach would be called for with our Department of Transportation to avoid some of those problems as we go through the rulemaking process.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, are we going to be hearing from, this is a question of you, if you don't mind, are we going to be hearing from the Department of Transportation regarding the provisions of this bill?
Representative, I don't see them in the room. So, are they here?
Yes.
Oh, they are here. Okay. Well, we certainly can call them forward. So,
I have questions, but not of this.
And we're also awaiting another representative that may be coming to testify.
That's fine. So. My questions are for
hold on. Okay. Any other questions for this witness? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, and so I guess at this point then we can ask the agency to come forward. Looks like we have some questions for you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tom McCall. I'm with the Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division, Department of Transportation.
And Representative Berger, if you have a question, please ask it.
I do. Sir, you've read the provisions of this law. I would like to know how the Department of Transportation intends to measure the social and economic costs of requiring more extensive documentation of legal presence in Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, our plan would be to contact Portland State or one of the major universities in the state to help us with that type of a study. We're not set up to do that type of research within our organization, so most likely it would be contracted services that we would utilize rather than our own staff.
And just a suggestion, too, because I know when I first looked at this, and I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, since one of the things that's been brought up is that victims of domestic violence frequently need to leave an abusive situation quickly, that there may be some issues for those families. And so I think that the Governor's Council, which has a lot of expertise, would be happy to work with the agency on this as well. Representative Berger, do you have another
question? I have further questions. So you would contract with Portland State or some other. Do you have any estimate of the cost of that contract and what it would involve in terms of DHS staff time to talk about some of these social and economic costs?
Madam Chair, Representative, we estimate in the neighborhood of $40,000 to $50,000 for Portland State as early estimates, depending on how broad you interpret social and economic change. That is the toughest part of this entire analysis. Some of these other things, rates of uninsured drivers, accidents, lots of good systems, lots of good data available to us for that type of a study, much more difficult when you get into social and economic impacts. It will be difficult to have it done by January of next year. That's the first reporting requirement in this. We do have a requirement in the governor's executive order to do a study, primarily on its effect on our customers and our organization. Our commission has asked for a broader look, that's why we contacted Portland State to try to get some additional information about how you could do a broader study on the effect on the state and its citizens, more so than just our agency and the people that we serve directly. So that was our plan. Like I said, we just started our contacts with researchers. The department has a research unit, or that research group, that does studies, and they'll probably help us in designing the study and setting up the contract.
Additional question?
No comment, if you want to know.
Go ahead.
Social and economic costs is language that I believe is way bigger than ODOT is prepared to deal with. I support this bill, every provision, but this wide open language of social and economic costs. I think ODOT's job is to study traffic and transportation issues, not social and economic issues with this kind of broad language. I mean, so they have the money to go to Portland State, Madam Chair, and design some sort of study around this. It won't get us anything but what we pay for, to tell you the truth, because this is just wide open. I also am very concerned that it'll require that the Portland State people start calling DHS people and asking all kinds of questions. We don't even know what that means, which is going to cost on the other end, on the general fund. And I just cannot. This is just too wide open a language for me. The social and economic costs is just too big a language for me to support. I'm sorry.
Well, Representative Berger, we do not have a motion in front of us, so I think I will take those comments. And
would the chair...
We're about to recess this hearing because we have another chair of a committee meeting to testify.
Would the chair accept amendments?
If I would amend. We're not in a work session.
Okay,
so I will recess the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3624. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3603. I know that Representative Holby is with us and has to chair his own committee. So if you would like to start off, and Marjorie, do you want to just tell us what we're looking at?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have House Bill 3603, which is related to mortgages, and we have the Dash 1 amendment that replaces the entire measure and establishes the Responsible Mortgage Lending Act and various other provisions. I'd like to call your attention to the fact that there are several blanks in this amendment that you would have to address, and they're on pages 10 and 11 of the amendment. And also in your packet, you have four pages of testimony from Ronald Grumman.
Okay, thank you, Marjorie, and good morning, Representative Holby. Thank you for waiting so patiently.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to come up first on this. This is I'm State Representative Paul Holby, District 8, from the Lane County, Eugene area. And I'm here to speak briefly on House Bill 3603. It was a bill that originally was designed to address loan originators, a concept that came out of the Mortgage Lending Task Force that we introduced on the House side, and shortly after we introduced it, it was taken up by the Senate, and that bill is still in the Senate, or I believe it's in Ways and Means right now. So that bill is still coming forward. So there was a great interest, and also some other pieces that we passed out that are really great legislation on mortgage foreclosure and foreclosure consultants and equity purchases, another piece of the Mortgage Lending Task Force. The task force itself did not decide to come forward with any provisions around mortgage lending practices. Senator Westland has a bill on that, Senate Bill 1090, that is in Ways and Means. We on the House side were very unsure whether we could pass that particular bill because it addresses a big concern in ability to pay. But the ability to pay sections, we felt on the House side anyway, from myself talking to many members, really didn't feel that we could pass that on the House side. It also was very unclear to the industry how we could address that in this February session. I don't believe we were able to come to any agreement that the impacts of this bill might actually around the ability to pay restrict access to loan products severely and have unintended consequences to the industry as well as to our real estate market in general. So we just, in that bill, as I mentioned, is in Ways and Means. We on the House side felt there was still a strong interest in looking specifically at prepayment penalties and some enhanced disclosures. And we're doing this at the same time the Federal Reserve is got proposed rules out for public comment that should be done in April, I believe. And there, it's unclear whether those rules will get implemented right away, next year, 2 years from now, and what form they will exactly take. They do have some proposals on ability to pay. They have proposals on yield spread premiums, and they have proposals on prepayment penalties. I feel that it's important the state of Oregon go ahead and address prepayment penalties and not to ban them, but simply to put some reasonable limits on prepayment penalties. As we wait to see what the feds do, not knowing how long it'll take, I think it's important that Oregon go ahead and add some protections in for the consumer around prepayment penalties. And then the Dash 1 amendments basically replace the bill, 3603, and are meant to just address the prepayment penalties, some disclosures, and also there's a section addressing the bonding amounts for brokers, which was a discussion that has been heard in this building in regards to Senate Bill 1090. And many in industry thought that we should raise the bonding levels to 100,000. Those amounts have been left blank for the committee to fill in after hearing some testimony. Some industry folks came to me with some concerns that raising it that much may restrict the amount of mortgage brokers that are in the market right now by making it a situation where they can't be bonded, perhaps because they don't have enough assets to be bonded for that. So I left that blank. I strongly feel that the bonding amount should go up. We'll wait to have that conversation and to hear other testimony to see what the feeling is about that piece. The prepayment penalty that's before you is basically limiting prepayment penalties to 2 years or 90 days before the reset of a adjustable rate product that is a subprime or untraditional loan. And that does differ slightly from the proposed rules from the Federal Reserve in that they have come out wanting to have the reset basically limited at 60 days before the prepayment penalty restricted at 60 days before the reset of a loan. And their proposal addresses all loans, though, not just subprime and untraditional. They also address prime loans in that. And they also have a different year. They have a five-year in the federal proposal, but that is limited in itself by the borrower's debt-to-income ratio, which is going to be further limiting to that. So although this isn't the same as the federal proposal, I think it does go down the same path as seeing that this is something that is really important, and they feel that this will go a long ways into helping prevent folks from getting trapped into the loans by having resets that come up at the same time that that they need to refinance. And so if they have a big prepayment penalty to make and their loan is going up, sometimes we get trapped in these loans, and the prepayment limits are meant to address that scenario by still allowing them, but making sure that they don't trap people into these higher loans. And I might add that, you know, there's a lot of folks who testified on Senate Bill 1090 who said that maybe we should just do away with prepayment penalties on home mortgages altogether. Some people think that perhaps we should wait till the Fed comes out with their proposals, and then, you know, because it's possible that those proposals will cover everybody, but that's an unknown fact. If we wait for the Feds to do this and they don't cover everybody, then we won't be the same as the Fed. And if we go first and go ahead and implement something, we won't be exactly the same as the Fed. So either way, we won't really be in lockstep with the federal proposal. Not saying we don't have to be, but it's probably a good thing for us to be close to that. I think that the prepayment penalty is something that's very concrete, is going to basically be good for consumers in the state of Oregon. So I would urge that we do look at those and have Oregon go ahead and implement a restricted limit on prepayment penalties. Because as we see, a lot of these subprime mortgages are now becoming due, and people will be trying to refinance those and reset with other loan products. We want to make sure that they don't get stuck into this same scenario of having big prepayment penalties going forward and have the same problem reoccur 2 years from now. So I think it's important that Oregon go ahead and go this direction on this particular issue. The bill also does address some foreclosure, some notice issues, some of which I believe are already done, but in Truth in Lending, but there may be some additional that we're requesting proposals, and a lot of it's around the compensation to the brokers. We want to make sure that there's good disclosure on what brokers are getting paid, and so we'd like to see that disclosure up front, and then if there's changes to that disclosure, that it be on that compensation, if there's changes to that compensation, that it be disclosed again 3 days before closing, and that that amount be locked in at that point. Those are the basic proposals around this bill, the bonding amount, the disclosures, and the prepayment penalty. I think there's probably others who will have opinions that this bill doesn't go far enough, and others that will probably say this bill goes too far. I just think it's important that we go ahead and act on this.
Thank you very much, Representative Holby. And we do also have Corey Streisinger, the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in the room and prepared to answer any technical questions that arise on this bill. Are there any questions for Representative Holby? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holby, let me just make sure I understand. You talked about the proposed Federal Reserve rules that... And I think what you outlined is the ideal situation of having alignment and not ending up with a two-tiered situation. I realize you can't predict what exactly the Federal Reserve is going to adopt and when, but is the 2 years after closing date already in the proposed Federal Reserve rules? But I understood you to say the 90 is actually 60 days in there. Maybe just outline one more time for me so I'm clear on the difference between this and the proposed Federal Reserve rules.
Well, the Fed proposal is actually, they're going to allow a prepayment penalty for up to 5 years, but that's only to borrowers whose debt-to-income ratio does not exceed 50%, which gets into sort of an ability to pay piece inside of the of that proposed rule, and figuring out what the debt to income ratio is, and that becomes very technical, And, you know, I think we looked at that and felt that we really couldn't accomplish that in this session as to trying to figure out the exact definition of what the Fed was going to come up with around a debt-to-income ratio. So instead of going with a five-year that's limited by a debt-to-income ratio, we decided to just come forward with a two-year limit on the subprime and untraditional mortgages. The other piece, the Fed proposal also wanted to have to impose a limit on prepayment penalties, that a prepayment penalty must expire at least 60 days before the first date on which any periodic payment amount may increase, which I'm referring to as the reset. So their proposal is that you can't have a prepayment penalty beyond that 60-day before the reset. And in the proposal that we have, it's 90 days. You know, that is a slight discrepancy, and certainly I'd entertain, you know, making it 60 days, but it's still not going to exactly match the Fed proposal at this point. And, you know, I'm put on the record that I think the Mortgage Lending Task Force will continue to look at this issue, as they will continue to look at many issues around ability to pay and other mortgage lending practices in the future. And, you know, if 2009 comes around and the Fed has actually implemented any of these, we can, you know, try to come into alignment at that time. But if the Fed does not, I think it's important that the state go ahead and have a limit in place to help prevent, you know, these future cases of people getting locked into these loans with huge prepayment penalties. And going forward, I think we'd be steps ahead of the game on that. Yeah, I hope I answered your question. Thank you.
And I was remiss in not welcoming the Vice Chair of the Consumer Protection Committee, Representative Bonamici, who has joined us at the dais. Thanks for being here. Any other questions for Representative Holby? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Please define for the committee, if you would, Representative, what is an untraditional mortgage?
And I'm wondering if maybe it would be appropriate
to have Cory come forward
at this point.
Yeah, I was just going to turn to the bottom of the
issue at that point. Self-made front man representing.
Delegate.
Does this mean I can leave?
Well, that would be up to you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cory Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and happy to offer whatever comments I can on the dash 1 minutes that are now before you. And I think Representative Esquivel's question was, what is a non-traditional mortgage?
Just for the
general purposes, and it is defined in the dash 1s. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, it's the category of mortgages that have an introductory interest rate that is lower than what the fully indexed rate will be. It may be an optional interest rate where the borrower can choose a level of interest for an initial period. And in some cases, it is an interest rate that has a negative amortization feature. In other words, you do not actually make payments that are sufficient to pay all the interest that you owe so that your principal balance grows for a period of time. It could also be an interest-only introductory period where you are not making any payments to reduce equity. The way the bill is structured, it also gives the department the ability to define those categories in rulemaking. But those are generally the types of loans that we think of when we talk about non-traditional mortgages.
Thank you for that clarification. And members, you probably found it already, but that definition is on page 3 of the dash 1, lines 2 through, looks like, 18. So it looks pretty specific. Are there other questions? Yes, Representative Esquivel, go ahead.
Yes, Cory, thank you, Madam Chair. On these dash 1 amendments, could you briefly tell us the difference between the dash 1 and the original bill? What specific are we changing here? Because I suspect in this dash 1 amendment that I'm maybe picking up that this should have a fiscal impact on not only your organization, but the Attorney General's.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, it's been a long day already. That's pretty bad. It's been a long day at 8:40. I meant to him this is a complete replacement. It's a gotten stuff with the original bill. The original bill was a parallel to a Senate-side bill that came out of the work group on mortgage lending, which the original bill dealt with the issue of loan originators, banning loan originators from the industry. And that bill has passed out of Senate Commerce in the form of Senate Bill 1064, and it will be in Ways and Means this afternoon. So this parallel bill, I believe, was viewed by the House membership as not being needed for that purpose, and therefore it now has language in it which had nothing to do with that original bill, but which does actually pick up a couple of concepts that were in the current version of Senate Bill 1090.
And just to clarify, too, Representative Esquivel, like every other bill, if this bill passes out of this committee, obviously there will need to be an analysis of what its fiscal impact would be, so rest assured that that is part of our process.
And, Madam Chair, if I could, although we saw a draft of this on Friday, we are, of course, just receiving the dash ones this morning, so we will be working on the fiscal. We've done some preliminary thinking about it, but we don't formally have a fiscal completed yet.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative?
This is for the panel. We saw the feds move pretty fast on the stimulus package. What are the chances for them moving pretty fast on whatever they're going to do in this arena? I'm a little uncomfortable getting ahead of the feds here when they're going to go between now and when we come in session. So, Representative Holby, do you have any notion of how the feds are going to do on this?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what they're
going to
do.
This is like,
could be timber payments on that.
Frankly, I don't think anybody does know exactly what. They're out for comment period right now, and they'll come back with those comments, and whether they act by the end of the year or 5 years from now, I don't think we really know. That's why I think it's incumbent upon the Oregon legislature, as far as the people and institutions that we can regulate, that we put a prepayment penalty in to address this in between time while we're waiting for the Fed to implement.
Follow up, Representative Berger.
Yeah, this is maybe a new direction. I just got this morning and I'm reading through it. And over the weekend I had things on my phone talking about folks who are kind of caught in this, and one of them was from a gentleman who said that he was caught up in this on his three rentals, which seems to me that if you're in the rental business, you're not in the homeowner business, and is there anything in here that says that this pertains only to your home and not, it just seemed to me that if he's in the rental business, there's business risk and signing loans. So I don't know if it's in there, but I would like to say that it's different for me protecting homeowners versus protecting people who are in the rental business.
I believe on page 3 in the definition of non-traditional mortgage that is intended for occupancy by 1 to 4 families and by the borrower as a principal residence.
And if I could add, actually, and there's just a little bit of drafting duplication, the definition of mortgage on page 2, lines 10 through 13, also says that it is intended for occupancy by 1 of 4 families and by the borrower as a principal residence. So it should be owner-occupied properties, although it could be up to a fourplex.
So, and you would then, in rule, take that and to be also, in other words, both would have
that's
to
correct.
Be. Yeah, I think that answers my question about that.
For some reason, that language appears in the overall definition of mortgage and in the sub-definition of non-traditional mortgage, not in the sub-definition of subprime mortgage, but that overarching definition we would interpret as applying all the way through.
Representative Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose this is for Corey. Corey, it's about the comparison of the disclosure requirements in this bill compared to the current truth in lending rules as well as the proposed truth in lending rules. Can you give us a comparison? How does this bill compare to the Federal Truth in Lending Act as well as the proposed Federal Reserve Board rules?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Shields, a number of the items in this required list are also required under Truth in Lending Disclosure. The intent of this is to require it in a plain language form that is upfront and that actually may contain less than the Truth in Lending discussion because the idea is to have key elements in a very clear, understandable way. So part of what the goal would be here would be to have us actually do some rulemaking around how do we get a small number of key pieces of information in front of the borrower. In addition, I believe that the calculation of the highest potential regularly scheduled payment, although of course could be derived from information that's disclosed, I don't believe that that in itself is a currently required disclosure.
Thank you.
Yes, who had a question?
Representative Bonamici.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had two questions, and Representative Shields asked my first, but fortunately I have another. I know there's some concern that was just expressed about getting out in front of what the Fed is doing. How do the provisions in this Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3603 compare to borrower protections that have been implemented in other states?
We're both looking at each other. I know that there's many other states that have implemented bans on prepayment penalties, for example, and put limits on prepayment penalties. Certainly, there's some that have looked at yield spread premiums and those sorts of issues. So it's not that Oregon is, you know, out here all by itself with the only state that is looking at or actually trying to implement some of these pieces. I think, you know, these are one step in the mortgage lending issues that many I think have said needs to happen. I've got a document actually here from see if I can remember, from Mark Tinnenfeld and from the Director of Office of Regulatory Policy for the American Bankers Association, and Robert Davis, who's the Executive Vice President and Managing Director for Government Relations with America's Community Bankers. And I just want to read this because, you know, I think this is, the industry recognizes that prepayment penalties are an issue, and it says, with respect to these products, we believe it is appropriate to restrict prepayment penalties. Many of the benefits from the use of prepayment penalties may be obtained and the problems avoided if prepayment penalties do not extend beyond 60 days before the first payment reset. And so we have, you know, a wide range of folks besides just states, industry, consumer groups, who all agree that prepayment penalty limits are something that we should be implementing to try to prevent some of these problems going forward. And, you know, I think that like many other states, Oregon should put in some sort of limit on prepayment penalties and take a look at this issue once again in 2009. I hope we revisit this and see where the Fed's at. Maybe they've acted, and if there's any issues that we need to adjust to make sure we don't have any problems, we can do that at that time. But it may take to 2011 for that to happen. And I don't think it's wise for the state of Oregon to sit back and do nothing in this specific arena.
And did you have another question, Representative Bonamici?
No, I did not. Thank you.
Great.
Representative Shields asked my question.
It's a right committee here. So Representative Berger.
Or Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back to your testimony, Representative Holden, you may have mentioned this, but maybe you can clarify for me, was this dash one amendment the result of sort of what's been referred to often as consensus, where you have the industry and stakeholders saying, well, these are points of agreement, or is this just pulling out the most, what you believe are the most pressing issues of this bill that is controversial, called Senate Bill 90?
No, this was not a consensus out of the Mortgage Lending Task Force. They chose not to address this particular issue because it was a big issue, I think, and rightfully, I don't think they could have solved it for this February session. The overall bill of the controversial bill, Senate Bill 1090, which many support, but many are don't. And so, you know, we in the House, I worked with some other legislators in talking about Senate Bill 1090, what pieces of this we thought we could implement this session without causing undue burden to the industry and not trying to address issues that we really couldn't address because the Fed's so intertwined with those, it's very hard for us to parse out. So these were a couple of pieces that came out. I think they're very, you know, they're good, solid steps that I think are small steps, but they're solid steps into solving some of the mortgage lending practices issues that have led to people being stuck in loans that they can't afford, which has led to foreclosures, which has brought on, you know, some huge economic impacts to our country. Even though Oregon hasn't been impacted as much as the rest of the country, it is a great concern that it is now. It actually is affecting our economy now. We have mills that are shutting down and laying people off because of the lack of demand for wood products in the home building industry across the nation. We have foreclosure rates that are, you know, skyrocketing in Oregon too. They're taking off, and we're expecting more foreclosures this year to continue to grow in our state, and that's not good for our economy, it's not good for our property values, and it's certainly not good for the consumers who have loans that are with huge prepayment penalties, and they're locked into them, they can't get out of them, and that has an impact on just the industry, it has an impact on our consumers, our property values, and so I think it's important that the state of Oregon comes out in front on this particular issue. And not wait for the Fed. And we, you know, like I said, I commit to working with the Mortgage Lending Task Force and looking at these issues as we go forward and as the Federal Reserve comes out with their proposed rules and to continue to work on these issues. But I think it's extremely important to take action this February on this.
Thank you, Representative Holby. Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, I'm sorry.
One more question. Yeah. On page 2, I'm finally getting a chance to read this. and I find on page 2, 3A, the language about owner occupancy. But above it, it says that it excludes federal banks, federal credit unions, financial institutions. And I assume that's because the feds have their own and we can't impose on them. Is that...
Well, Corey's probably better able to answer that, but I think we're preempted from regulating federal institutions.
On that assumption, my question is, what percentage or how many then of these kinds of loans are not covered in Oregon by this? I mean, if this were enacted, there would be a big hole where if you have... You know, if it was a federal credit union, this wouldn't count for you, so you've kind of got a two-tiered thing going here. And I just went into the percentage of loans, and I...
Corey may be able to answer that percentage, but, you know, the fact of this bill is, the federal already has guidelines that they follow. They're voluntary guidelines, though. And so we have an industry around mortgage brokers and state charters that don't follow those guidelines. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. They're not required to. So, you know, I think this bill will help fill that hole or fill that gap in regards to those that we can regulate around prepayment penalties specifically and the plain language disclosure. I think so.
pull me out of the dirt there, would you?
Chair Representative Berger, it's a good question because there's certainly many, many home loans in Oregon that don't fall within our regulatory jurisdiction. I'll have to get you the exact number. I believe it's, and this is a wide range, in 40 to 60% range that we do regulate, meaning that it's in the 40 to 60% that we don't, but I'll have to get you that exact number. As you can see, I don't remember which way those numbers flip.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, Chris, you'll never get out of here.
thank you. I just maybe think there's a couple more questions. Do we have any statistics or data on how many of these foreclosures occurring in Oregon are from financially chartered, regulated entities versus state-regulated entities? And
I think Representative Thatcher, that was the question that they were just attempting to answer.
No,
I'm not
it wasn't that. Based on foreclosures from
loan volume
originated by federally chartered versus state chartered. I'm just wondering if there's any information about that, and also about the causes. Is it because of escalating adjustable rate mortgages, or is it because of the prepayment penalties? Is it because they just didn't know and they didn't have enough disclosure? I'm just wondering if there's any data on the reasons for foreclosure, and are we getting at those reasons?
I'll answer part of that and then turn it over to Corey. I don't know specifically about whether we have delineated the amount of foreclosures, state versus federal. Corey may speak to that. But the whole piece of this is that people get stuck in these adjustable rates sometimes, and they get stuck in some of these loan products where their payments escalate, their interest rates go up, and they go up far enough to where they don't have the ability to pay for them anymore. And that's at the crux of the problem nationwide, is that people get into these loans, that they thought they could pay for, and it ends up that they can't for whatever reason, whether it's because there wasn't underwriting done on them, or whether they thought the market was going to appreciate so they could refinance with based on the equity that they had, and clearly some of those things haven't happened. But the piece that's before us now is on the prepayment penalty, which has an effect of having an excessive prepayment penalty when somebody's stuck in one of those situations where the payments are going up to the point where they can't afford it, that they certainly can't afford to make the prepayment penalty, so they're locked into that loan. They can't refinance. So this piece is just meant to put some reasonable limits on that prepayment penalty so that people at least have a shot at refinancing without having an excessive prepayment penalty preventing them from doing it.
And did you have a comment? I guess it is an interesting question because it sounds like there could be a combination of reasons when there is a foreclosure about why it happens. And I guess I'm curious, not having been on the Consumer Protection Committee, is there some method of collecting that information after the fact? I mean, are people surveyed, or is this just who happens to contact your agency?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, two things. First of all, we can see whether we've got data for you on the foreclosure rates and how they compare with state versus federally chartered institutions. Generally speaking, we do have some data sources that come from industry about what loan types are more likely to be in foreclosure. And what we are seeing, you've probably heard, Oregon is still doing fairly well compared to other parts of the country in terms of our foreclosure rates, but the numbers do not look so pretty when you look at subprime loans, and particularly what are sometimes called option ARM loans, the ones that allow you to make an interest payment that you choose that may not be enough to pay off the interest rate, and then ultimately the loan escalates very significantly so that you will be paying off the negative amortization as well as the original amount. And in those types of loans, the foreclosure rates are significantly higher. I believe our numbers show that 7% of those loans are more than 90 days delinquent today. And over the past 2 years, we saw about 88,000 subprime and adjustable rate loans being made, that generally the increase features kick in after about 2 years. So we are concerned about 2008. We have a large array of loans with some of these features that have led to significantly higher foreclosure rates, which are coming up. And there are, of course, some good signs on the market, which is that a lot of the lenders who make these loans actually do have forbearance and workout programs in place now, because they do not want to take these loans, these homes, back into inventory. That hurts their balance sheet. But nevertheless, it is important for people who face these loans to have options, whether it's through their own lender or whether it's through refinancing, because a lot of these are subprime borrowers and the subprime credit market has essentially dried up. They may have real challenges finding a new loan that they can qualify for, but if their credit has improved and they can qualify, for example, for an Alt-A product, having them locked in by an existing prepayment penalty obviously makes their lives harder. Now, the existing loans won't be affected by this bill. This bill addresses loans that will be made after the effective date of this bill. Generally speaking, in this whole area of lending practices, whether it's addressed this session or through the federal rules or in the 2009 session, what we want to do is to make sure that the quality of loans that we see in the future takes care of some of these problems so that we don't get into the same hole that we're in today.
I've got a couple of questions over here, and then I'll go to you, Representative Escobar.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to let everyone know on subprime. Subprime is B money. It's high risk. People with poor credit and or no credit history and or no job history. So it is a high-risk loan. Now, having said that, let's talk about that subprime part. A lot of people are in houses today because of subprime loans. Let's not forget those people. We're at 1.4% foreclosure rate in this state. Let's not forget the 98.6% of the people that are in their houses and doing well. The other thing that I'm concerned with here is we start dabbling too much in this, and I think it's a federal issue. I really think it's a federal issue. I think Fannie and Freddie have tightened their guidelines to the point of where it's becoming more and more difficult for these types of loans to be out. And I think if you talk to any mortgage broker, there's very few of them, if any, at all now. But let's not get to the point where we send these people, by making laws, to a private lender. If you start getting into private lenders, we don't control private lenders at all. Let's be very, very cautious here. The other thing that I've run into two foreclosures in Southern Oregon. Neither one of them had to do with subprime. They all had to do with an arm that clicked in later on. But the real problem was forbearance programs that were unregulated. The real problem was the servicer, not the lender, not the mortgage broker, not the market itself. It was the servicer company, which is, we don't regulate. They can add on fees, and let me tell you what a servicer is for people that don't know. You have someone that lends you the money. They in turn, let's say I'll use an ABC bank. It's a federal bank. They give this loan over to what they call a servicer. The servicer administers that loan, make sure it's collected and what have you. Now, what's happened in both cases that I know of, that the people have called up and said, hey, I'm going to miss a payment. Servicer was very nice. Said, sure, no sweat. Over the next 6 months, pay a sixth higher. No problem. At the end of 6 months, they should be even. They aren't, because of fees and penalties that have been added onto this. Plus, they went into a forbearance program that you mentioned, Corey, that they were unaware of. So, they want to talk it over with these people, and all of a sudden, these people won't talk to them. So, they go to the bank. Let's go talk to ABC Bank. ABC Bank doesn't even have the loan in their system, because they've turned it over to the servicer. So these people have no one to talk to at this point. So they get angry and they say, well, we're going to run down, we're going to refi this. Come to find out, the servicer has been whacking their credit for 6 months, and it's a home whacking on your home payment. So therefore, you won't be eligible for 2 to 4 years to get a loan on a home again. It's a catch-22. The consumer is completely unaware of it. This, I repeat, goes back to a federal issue. Some of these people owe as much or more than the original default. So those are the things I think the federal government has to work on, because no matter what we do here, that's not going to fix that. But I want to be very, very cautious of everyone to make sure that we do not, I repeat, we do not make this lending to the point of where we're sending people to a private lender where they're going to get whacked 3 to 5% more than they would if they went to an institutional lender.
Thank you, Representative. I don't know that there was a question embedded there, but if you
want to
comment.
I'd like to make just a quick comment. I'm aware of Representative Esquivel's notion, or actually it is more than a notion, of a problem with servicers.
It might be a great notion.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have those in this committee.
In regards to the subprime and untraditional mortgages that we're talking about around these prepayment limits, we are not, you know, outlawing prepayment subprime loans in this bill. We're not banning subprime or untraditional mortgages in this bill. All we're doing is putting a limit on how the prepayment penalties are. So it is a small step. It doesn't address all the problems. I know the servicers are a huge problem. I don't know if the lenders are ultimately responsible for the practices of, you know, the servicers they use to service their loan portfolio or not. That's, you're right. There's a lot of federal issues tied into this. But at this point, this is a step that Oregon can take around. Specifically, we're not solving the whole problem of the mortgage lending crisis. We're not solving a lot of these other problems that are federal problems. But this is a step Oregon can take that will help Oregon consumers. So.
Okay, and we do have quite a few witnesses signed up to testify on this, too. But next I'll recognize Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Very briefly, Representative Holby, could we get a copy of the letter that you referenced in your testimony from the...
Yes, I'll make that available.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and Representative Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of us in the next session or two might be on business, labor, and consumer affairs, or however it gets apportioned in the future. But I think it's really important for us to understand the history of this issue. Representative Esquivel suggests that this is a federal issue, and that certainly it is significantly a federal issue. But, Corey, maybe you can address Representative Holby. I mean, how do we get to this point? Was it just a convergence of market forces? Was it actions taken at the federal or state level, or lack of action taken at the federal or state level? Can you give us a small answer? I mean, if you look at the S&L debacle of the 80s, there are 5 or 6 points where if the government might have gone down a different track, it might not have ended up where it did.
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I can give you a sort of 30,000-foot summary. We had, over the past 3 to 5 years, rapidly escalating real estate prices, and we had a great deal of appetite for high-yield debt in the international securities market. And so mortgages were being made based on the assumption that real estate prices would continue to rise, and that the mortgages could be refinanced to draw out equity or to replace features as they kicked in. And then those fairly high-yielding instruments were repackaged and sold in the international securitized collateral mortgage obligations market. And many people in the industry will tell you that it was, in fact, one of those sort of bubble mindsets where loans would be made virtually to anybody without a great deal of documentation, stated income loans or low documentation or no documentation loans. And, of course, then once real estate prices started to level off, or in many parts of the countries started to go head downward, and a lot of those creative interest rate features kicked in. Foreclosure rates started to rise, and a lot of those holders of those bundled securities became very distressed and swung from, you probably heard the cycle of that people talk about in the investment world between fear and greed, and the greed end of the spectrum became unpalatable, and we're now heavily over into the fear end of the spectrum, so that the credit markets have significantly tightened up, and there's basically no appetite for these types of secured mortgage products. Banks are doing financing from their own assets, and prime loans are still a attractive product, but not these alternative and subprime products. And then in the meantime, of course, as real estate prices have flattened, people are unable to make those higher payments. They are unable to refinance because of the collapse in the credit market. Foreclosure rates spike up, and you can see the cycle. Now, to what extent is this federal versus state? States regulate state-chartered institutions, state mortgage lenders, but those mortgage lenders repackage into the securitized market as well. Many of the ultimate money sources are not here in the state for loans that mortgage brokers place here. And banks have a choice of a state or a federal charter. So it is a problem much bigger than Oregon. Oregon has actually been insulated to a certain degree because our real estate rates have stayed high, unlike much of the country. But I think that's the reason that you are seeing attention paid at the national level, because the implications for the credit markets have been so severe, really way beyond just the harm to the individual consumers whose homes are at risk.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that just briefly. You know, just looking at it from the 100,000-foot level, not the 30,000-foot, because I don't fly quite as close to this as Corey does, but, you know, these untraditional and subprime loan products, you know, probably have a place in a lender's portfolio, and you know the country went through a lot of emphasis in trying to increase home ownership to the point where it's my opinion that the industry at the federal level decided that they would really put a lot of focus on these sorts of products. They were profitable, and plus they met this goal of increasing home ownership. But I guess I would contend that the percentage of these loan products in the industry's portfolio is grown to such a large percentage of their portfolio that it became financially irresponsible to have that many risky loans in your portfolio, and that's something that I think has helped this, or not helped, but has led this country into the economic crisis that we're looking at now, because they've got way too much risky paper out there, and not enough people to pay for it.
If that's my fellow, Madam Chair.
Yes, and members, we do have people who have come especially to testify on this, as well as some people who are here every day, so I would like to be sure that we get testimony from the public.
Fair enough. The last part, though, has there been discussion of any lack of action that the federal government did not take that got us here? I mean, we're looking at a potential huge bailout of the industry at the federal level. Has that been discussed?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Shields, this cluster of issues started getting attention at the national level, I would say about a year ago, when a number of the federal regulators issued guidance for non-traditional loans. But it was guidance, and I think you're now seeing, as often is the case, that once the whatever the fear was actually occurs, the attention is a lot more focused. And there are bills pending, as well as the Federal Reserve rule pending. There is a fairly substantial bill that has passed the House of Representatives, but has not received action in the Senate.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici, did you have a
Madam Chair,
question?
No, I don't have a question. I just have an analysis of the loan originations in the year 2006 by House District, which I will provide to the committee because it is broken down by House District. And on the average, it shows that more than a quarter of the loans in 2006 were subprime. And you can look at where your district ranks in terms of the number of subprime loans. And it is for 2006, but it is useful to see for guidance. I'll provide
that. So if you could provide that to the staff, we'll get copies to the members. Okay. Well, seeing no further questions, it looks like you're off the hook. And
thank you very much,
Madam
Chair, committee, for entertaining this
bill. Thank you, Representative Hogan. Next, I'll call Steve Emery and Paul Cosgrove and John McCulley.
Madam Chair,
Jim Markey with me. Sure. And please go ahead, because we do have quite a few people to testify on this. Just
identify
yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm Steve Emery. I'm a mortgage broker. I've been in business close to 20 years. I also chaired the Ethics Committee for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals from 1999 to 2003. I've also taught numerous compliance classes. I've also analyzed the federal proposed rules, 163 pages worth, extensively, and I have them here. I want to ditto, I agree with just about everything that Representative Holby said, 100%. I also want to say that I also agree a lot with what Representative Esquivel said regarding we don't want these loans to go away. And having said that, I basically agree with the general intent of this bill, and I think this is a good way to go. Having said that, there's some minor changes we can make, which need to be made so that we don't lose these loans. And I haven't I've testified a couple of times in SB 1090 in opposition to it, and some of the points I have not brought up before because the bill was so bad, I was having to just go against it 100%. But now that we're down to these little certain points that I support, I want to address a couple of minor issues that will fix it and make it a good bill. One of the first things I want to talk about is the definition of subprime. Currently, the federal government in the proposed rules is dealing with this definition. One of the things that's talked about is comparable treasuries. They spend an entire page talking about comparable treasuries, what dates, which type of treasuries, and everything else, because you don't just do 30-year to 30-year, as most people would think. I think that this is going to be changed in the federal proposed rules. That would be my guess. There's a lot of people talking about that. And we can change our definition to an extremely simple definition. If we put back in the qualified automated underwriting system definition in this bill, which is right in SB 1090, so LC can just copy and paste it right back in, it defines qualified underwriting systems. There's two tiers of qualified underwriting systems. There's the federal systems, and then there's proprietary systems. The proprietary systems are done with subprime lenders. Subprime lenders use proprietary systems. They do not use the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac systems. So the Freddie Mac, by definition, if you have a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac approved loan, which is automated underwriting system, it was a prime loan. It is not a subprime loan, because if it's approved in that system, it's going to be prime. So now we can put in a new subprime definition, where a subprime debt mortgage means a debt that's secured by a mortgage or trustee on real property in the state that's basically a principal residence. I'm kind of paraphrasing here. If you can read it later at your content. The mortgage of the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services identifies by rule, but then here's the key part. It is a subprime mortgage does not include a mortgage that is commonly underwritten by the qualified automated underwriting systems the Office of Federal Housing Oversight, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, has developed. This will make a very clear and precise definition for industry, which is a bright line, which is what we need to comply with this type of a statute. This will make, it will differentiate between subprime and prime loans very clearly, and matter of fact, I hope the Fed uses this particular definition. Secondly, on prepayment penalties, our text is a little ambiguous. There's parts in our text which I don't even understand part of it where it talks about something not being applied. But if you copy the federal text on page 128 of this document, we can just copy and paste right out of this, LC can, and use the federal text but put in subprime or non-traditional mortgage and then use 2 years, and it is 5 years in the federal tax, and then the prepayment penalty in 60 days. You don't need that qualifier phrase that's in there, which will cause industry concern. That qualifier phrase is what's ambiguous and a problem. So this will match us up with the federal thing, except that we'll have 2 years instead of five, which I personally agree with. I think that's fine. I do not think, if we do these two changes, we will not reduce the availability of credit in this state. If we don't make these changes, we can potentially, with unintentional consequences, reduce the availability of credit. The third one is the disclosure text on compensation. The idea behind this, I support 100%. I think I've made numerous suggestions to this effect to copy some of the Washington statutes, state of Washington, that is. The only problem I have with it is, and if you notice, I've got some red in here and some line outs on my part of it. I think we need to take out this, or to another person that provides negotiating, broking, funding, or related services. The problem with that little sentence, well, it may make sense to a layperson, that has a potential of bringing in SRP and other types of disclosures of income that may come 2 months, 3 months, 4 months after the transaction, which then will scare industry, and industry will freak out if this is in there. So we gotta get that part out. As far as disclosing our compensation to mortgage brokers in detail, and then if it changes, I think that was a great addition. I hadn't seen that before, but I love that addition, and I think that's great. We just have to make sure. If you notice, all three of my points are basically clarifying and creating bright lines for each of these definitions, which then makes industry able to comply with them, which means we will not reduce the availability of credit, which I'm all for, and Representative Esquivel was mentioning. One last point, which I didn't put in my written testimony, is I was originally the one that was talking about trying to increase bonding to $100,000. I've since, after talking with a few insurance companies and a couple other people in the industry, realized that that probably would be a little excessive for a small company. But I do strongly recommend that we at least double it to $50,000. Right now it's currently $25,000. That doesn't give a consumer or a consumer's attorney anything to go after. Not that I want that, but you know, there's got to be enough there. So I think a small business should at least have $50,000 of bonding. I would raise the maximum, though. I think the maximum of 100 is too low. I think, you know, companies that have 20 branches can easily afford to have $150,000, $200,000 bond myself. I'm happy to answer questions about the Federal Reserve stuff. I'm happy to answer questions about this. I'm done.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. I think we'll hear from the other witnesses and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgo, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I'm just going to talk about three issues: process, including where the Federal Reserve is; substance, including some significant problems with the 3603-1 amendments; and implementation of this and costs, both to the state and to regulated lenders. But first, let me tell you who Oregon Financial Services Association's members are. We are, Mr. Emery is a broker who obtains loans from lenders. My members are lenders. And in fact, my members have been making what are now called subprime loans for decades, long before the term subprime was ever invented, long before there were ever such things as adjustable rate mortgages. They are some of the few lenders left in the state still making loans to people with challenged credit, whereas most of the subprime market, as Ms. Streisinger pointed out, has vanished, and people who have that kind of credit standing have far fewer options right now. My members are, in fact, some of those still available options. And so we have a deep concern about hasty regulation of us as state-chartered subprime lenders still working in the market. And I think Representative Holby pointed out that it's important to look at what the impact of this legislation will be. You talk about concern about restrictions on brokers in terms of the bonding requirements. I'm going to try to focus about concern from lenders on the restrictions on lenders that will affect the availability of credit. Secondly, on the Federal Reserve, there's been some discussion, how broad would it be? My handout is from the Federal Reserve website, and it reflects the scope of the current rules that were published January 8th. The comment period ends April 8th, and it's far broader than anything that this body, either side of the building, has considered this session. It deals with advertising, it deals with yield spread premiums, it deals with prepayment, all the issues you've heard, plus a bunch more. But the scope and impact of those rules will affect every creditor, because they are amendments to the Truth in Lending Act. Truth in Lending Act affects every creditor, whether it's a regulated or unregulated lender as long as they make 4 loans a year. So it will have broad impact. And in fact, the feds are the people who are the experts on disclosure. They, Truth in Lending is the Federal Disclosure Act. They are the experts on Equal Credit Opportunity. They enforce that Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And in the process of looking at those rules, they're going to look at what is effective disclosure, what is the best disclosure, what is confusing disclosure, what is the best way to ensure that those who need credit continue to have the availability credit without discrimination. So I would caution you that our view is, one, the Federal Reserve, having been blamed for part of this problem by making credit too easy, under new leadership is shown that it's quite willing and able to break from that past and do things quickly. That will happen relatively quickly, and to the extent we are different from the feds, the proposal here for prepayment is both less encompassing and more strict at the same time than what the feds are currently considering. We won't cause a dislocation in the market. And that brings me to substance. There's been a question raised about subprime and who's responsible for most of these exotic loans that are problems. I can tell you that the anecdotal general press that you're all been reading, the lenders you're hearing about who have, one, been the largest mortgage lenders in the subprime market in the country, are all federally chartered. Those are the ones who've constricted dramatically. The ones who are left are the ones who've been here before the crisis, continue to be here, and are state chartered. And what you are doing is placing restrictions on them that will be different from and potentially confusing. And I agree with Mr. Emery on one point, which is there is a lot of difficulty in figuring out how this will actually be implemented. And that is my final point. This bill is very complicated. This issue is very complicated. The definition of non-traditional mortgage as set forth in the bill as it currently exists, and yes, the department has the ability to pass rules to further define it, will encompass every home equity line of credit offered by a state-chartered institution, and nearly every home equity loan that isn't the line of credit by a state-chartered institution, regardless of interest rate. I went on a lender that has published their rates on the web. It's a lender I've done business with in the past. I had a home equity line of credit with them for some years. Every single one of their 8 offerings is either a non-traditional mortgage as currently defined or a subprime mortgage as currently defined. This is one of the state's well-respected traditional lenders, state-chartered lenders. And absent a very quick process for DCBS to do things that are very complicated, and I would suggest to you very expensive to determine what is the appropriate line to draw, we're going to adversely affect all of those markets, regardless of interest rate, for all state-chartered institutions, those be banks, credit unions, and my members. And I would suggest to you what that does is effectively reduce the availability of credit for those people who need it most now, who are having their loans reset, and makes it less likely they'll be able to avoid foreclosure. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll hold questions, and we'll go to Jim Markey. It's great to see you. Welcome to the Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm sorry I didn't get signed up earlier. I was late. Apologize for that. Jim Markey, representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, and our association is the Oregon affiliate of the Mortgage Bankers of America, MBA. We have federally chartered banks, state chartered banks, credit unions, non-depository mortgage lenders, commercial mortgage lenders. We have sort of a smattering of them all. And this bill is of great concern to us. I want to start by thanking the governor for putting together the mortgage lender work group, which I served on and Colin Steve served on. And particularly, I also want to thank Representative Hovey and Representative Bonamici, who I believe were at every meeting that we have had, and most of the legislation regarding foreclosure consultants and regulation of originators was drafted, I think, by Representative Bonamici, with help from Chris Ambrose, our past president, who was actively engaged in the work group as well. When we entered the process with the work group, I just want to point out that we were, our intention had always been, and at least within the industry representatives on the group, we believed that we were entering a process wherein we were kind of looking at short-term goals and long-term goals. The short-term goals being, let's do what we can for people in foreclosure that are moving into foreclosure immediately. Let's deal with the issue of foreclosure consultants, which is a growing concern. Let's look at those kinds of things that we can do. And then, and we'll deal with that in the special session, and then following the special session, it was always our intention that the group would continue to meet, and I believe it was the governor's intention as well, to continue meeting and look at potential lender reforms. We wanted to move somewhat slowly on those reforms because we wanted to see what the federal government was going to do, and we wanted to look at what kinds of restrictions they were going to come down with, because as Representative Berger pointed out in her questioning, whatever we do here will only affect state chartered institutions, state regulated institutions, and we don't feel it's a good idea to have two sets of rules for people operating across the street from each other. I mean, you got a federally chartered bank on one side of Main Street and a state chartered bank on the other side of Main Street, and you got two sets of rules, and you can create a competitive disadvantage for one or the other by what you do here. So we just think that's unwise. And we would like to see the work group continue and proceed. Now, MBA publishes a lot of data, and I just want to go through a little bit of it, because MBA does a quarterly survey of lenders covering close to 90% of all lenders in the nation. They voluntarily give information regarding delinquencies and foreclosures, and MBA publishes a quarterly report that has all of that information in it, not by lender, but by overall categories. And if you compare Oregon, and you know, everybody understands that there's a huge problem nationally with foreclosures, but if you compare Oregon to the national picture, we stack up pretty darn good. We measure 30 days delinquent, 60 days delinquent, 90 days delinquent, seriously delinquent, foreclosure starts, foreclosure inventories. We have categories for FHA loans, vets loans, prime versus subprime, conventional loans, overall loans. In every category that MBA has published their reports in, consistently over the last year to 2 years, Oregon has ranked 47th, 48th, 49th, or 50th out of 50 states in every category. We ought to be proud of that. That's something we ought to be talking about and saying, wow, we're doing a pretty good job here. Our foreclosure rates remain at about half the national average. And I know Representative Escobar said 1.4%, but I believe we're about 0.6% for all loans. If you look at fourth quarter 07 versus over fourth quarter 06, the increase for that year, national average, or nationally, foreclosures are up 75% for that 1 year period. Up 75% nationally. Michigan is up 90%. Oregon, for the same period, and this is realty track information, up 12% for that period. That's something we ought to be proud of. Our foreclosure rates in Oregon today are lower than they were 4 or 5 years ago. And we didn't see a hue and cry here 4 or 5 years ago to do the kinds of things we're talking about here today. It is in the subprime category, foreclosure rates are clearly higher than in other categories, prime, or other all loans. That shouldn't come as a shock to anybody. When you loan money to people who have poor credit, have a history of not paying their bills, the risk is higher and foreclosures, delinquencies are going to be higher and foreclosures are going to be higher. I mean, that shouldn't come as a shock to anybody. There were some questions about causes of foreclosure, and there is some information nationally about that, and almost half of foreclosures are caused by job loss. Primary reason in the country is job loss. There are some other reasons, and they include one that I like to talk about. Almost half of people in foreclosure never contact their lender throughout the foreclosure process. And generally, lenders want to work these things out because they don't want the house back. So I think that in pointing that out, my reason for pointing that out is that is there some need to rush to something before the feds move on their rules? Maybe not in Oregon, maybe in some other states, some more serious problems. Certainly, we want to be responsible and we want to look at these lender reforms. But it is pretty clear to everybody involved in this process that the feds are going to do something this year. I mean, we're in a comment period. Those are going to be adopted. And we think it's just very irresponsible to wind up with two sets of rules for different folks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And are there questions for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Bonucci.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question is for Mr. Amory. You mentioned the prepayment penalty mirroring the Federal Reserve proposal. Did you anticipate that including the debt-to-income ratio portion of the federal proposal or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Bonamici, no, I did not include that because, again, I think that would get to the level of complication that would create too many problems with industry and there would not be any hope of consensus or support. I think that on a federal level is also being addressed by industry and there's a lot of concerns and questions in that area as well, and I would hate to do something that, again, I would agree with Jim Markey that we don't want to do something that the feds would create two different rules for both groups of both parties, but I think we are going to do something with some sort of prepayment penalty tax, and if they have a 5-year and a 60-day, and we have a 2-year and a 60-day, I don't see that as a restriction in credit myself.
Thank you. And a brief follow-up to Mr. Cosgrove. You talked about the how the definition of non-traditional mortgage in this amendment will encompass every home equity line of credit. And with this proposal being so limited, it doesn't ban, it limits prepayment penalties, and enhances disclosure, my thought is, what's wrong with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bonabinci, getting down to some of the specifics, some of the proposed disclosures are in fact inconsistent with truth in lending. Most of us would like to get out of disclosures that are inconsistent with truth in lending. Some of these things are issues that will not be resolved until after lengthy rulemaking, and we won't know what they will be for many months after this bill is passed. It has emergency clause with delayed effectiveness, but only for 120 days. There are a lot of pieces of uncertainty here, and we don't know how far it goes, except that we do know it only goes to state chartered institutions.
Very brief follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Cosgrove, do you know offhand which are inconsistent with the truth in lending?
Some of these proposals for disclosure talk about plain language and I only got this yesterday morning. Some of us take the seventh day as rest, so if I can't find exactly quickly the thing, but I believe that in the disclosure section it talks about
on page 5
more visible, more prominent. There's words to that effect. Under truth of lending, nothing can be more prominent than the federal box, than the disclosure annual percentage rate and finance charge. So if DCBS is going to have to deal with this, it's going to have to tell us how it can be done consistent with truth in lending, and that's going to be a complicated process.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Thatcher.
Well, I'm sure. Previous testimony, we're told that the prepayment penalties wouldn't apply to any existing loans. Obviously, it would be for everything looking forward. And when you look at this this bill, is it addressing the problems that are trying to be addressed at this point, looking forward? And do you think, are we just trying to do something at this point? And is it going to complicate things if we come back and revisit and change things around, you know, in a few months from now when we go into 09 session?
Madam Chair, if I may briefly respond with at least one thought. Yes, it will make things more complicated. And yes, it's almost certain to be inconsistent with what the Federal Reserve does. It'll be different one way or another. We already know that based on the fact that this is intended, for example, in prepayment only to apply to subprime or non-traditional. The Fed is looking at restrictions on prepayment for all loans, and looking at the whole range of loans, and it will affect everybody together. Yes, this will be complicated. Yes, this will be different, and I expect we'll be back in January if anything like this passes to address it. Prepayment penalties, if they are limited in this way, and in fact changed from a number of my members what they now do, they all release people from prepayment if it's close to a reset. But their prepayment penalties last, generally speaking, 3 years rather than 2 years. What they'll have to decide is whether the risks of having DCPS for violating of a rule or uncertain language appointing a receiver to take over their operation, they'll have to decide whether that risk is worth continuing to make subprime loans in this state. And many of them will decide not.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And Jim, actually, Representative Berger had asked if we could get a copy of some of the statistics that you cited in your testimony. If you could put that in writing and get that to the committee members,
absolutely,
that would be great.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, I will call Lieutenant Liz Carruthers, and I see John McCulley and Todd Williams are both in the room. John? Yeah. Okay. And why don't the three of you come forward? And I'm going to ask you to try to limit your testimony a little bit because we do have a lot of other people signed up. We're going to run out of time before we get to everybody. But I know you traveled to get here, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, you unofficially promoted me. I'm technically just a detective.
Ah.
Not nearly as special as a lieutenant. I'm here today. I'm a real estate investor. I own 5 rental properties.
Yeah, could you identify yourself for the record?
Across the nation, my name is Liz Carruthers. I work for Portland Police. I'm a white-collar crime investigator, and I've been working on real estate fraud cases almost exclusively for the past 2 years. I was asked at the last minute to come down here and give you my take on what I've seen in my fraud investigation, so I apologize for my attire. In the last 2 years, I have been working real estate fraud cases almost exclusively, particularly the foreclosure bailout scams. I went and testified at the governor's committee for one day and explained my position to them then. I'll reiterate it here. In my experience, 100% of the cases involving a foreclosure bailout scam involves a loan originator. And in fact, in all of the real estate fraud investigations that I have heard of that are being conducted either by a state agency or a federal agency or in other states, 100% of the time involve loan originators or mortgage brokers. I've looked at the bill as of 2 hours ago when I printed it out, and I implore you to please, please pass some sort of regulation protecting consumers from loan originators who are acting with ill intentions. Granted, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that 100% of them are bad guys, but there is a percentage of them out there that are, and hopefully I'll send them all to jail. If I may comment, one issue was brought up about the bond being at about $25,000. I don't know if you know this or not, but for many mortgage brokers, that's chump change. That's what they earn in a month in some cases. I will also tell you in my experience that the problems that I've seen with loan originators are not with the big banks like Wells Fargo, Bank of America, although they're not immune from having problems. The majority of the problems that I've seen and or heard of are involving the smaller independent companies. I'll give you an example. If you want to look on the internet and Google it, National City Bank is suing a Portland company called Evergreen Funding. It's either Evergreen Funding or Evergreen Lending, for a total of $14 million. Evergreen Funding or Lending, whichever it is in Portland, Oregon. And that is a mortgage brokerage that was involved, allegedly, in overinflated appraisals and pressuring of the appraisers for overstated values. And in many cases, they directly, according to the lawsuit, lied to the lenders involved and even falsified whether or not there was actually construction ongoing. You can look that case up on the internet. It's public record. It's filed in the, I believe, the Southern District of Ohio. It's in federal court. That's just one example of some of the problems that are out there. I have been trained in real estate fraud by an appraiser in the state of Washington by the name of Richard Hager. He has been an appraiser for 30 years. He is considered an expert witness in state and federal court in the state of Washington. He also teaches loan originators and mortgage brokers, realtors, appraisers, and law enforcement officers how to investigate these cases and how to spot these cases. I just spoke with him on my way down here. And his contention is that maybe 1 in 100 cases involving a yield spread premium is legitimate. I will tell you what he has told me and what he teaches in his classes. A yield spread premium is simply nothing more than the lender rewarding the loan originator or the mortgage broker for getting the consumer or the homeowner into a worse loan than what they qualify for. I can leave with you here a HUD-1 that I brought involving an ongoing criminal case that I have. I'll black out the names if you want copies of it. I ask each of you to try and find on the HUD-1 where the yield spread premium is. It's hard to find. It's buried. And in this particular case, an elderly woman was swindled out of her home by a loan originator, and she got an $8,000 yield spread premium in addition to stealing the house for pennies on the dollar. I'm here representing those people. Do something. I don't care if you keep the yield spread premium, but by all means, can we have some big banner in the closing documents stating exactly what it is? That it's a bonus for the loan originator because you got a worse loan than you qualify for. That's really what they are. I don't know what you've been told about yield spread premiums, but that's what they are. If you would like, I will leave you with a copy of that HUD-1, and you can see if you can find the yield spread premium. It's on page 2. I'll give you that as a hint. As far as the foreclosure consultant bills go, I don't think that bill goes far enough. Again, in 100% of the cases that I've seen, it's not just a citizen that is stealing people's homes. They're loan originators or mortgage brokers, 100% of the time. In the city of Portland, what we are doing that I hope maybe the Department of Justice may adopt at some point in time, we get copies of the notice of default list that is sent out by the lenders and title companies, public record. I send that list to our secretary in the white collar crime unit, and every 2 weeks she sends out letters to homeowners warning them about the potential scams they may face as a result of being in default. I've talked to citizens in numerous occasions.
Could you just move the mic so it's pointed a little more at you? It sounds like you're cutting out a little bit.
Sorry.
Thanks.
I send these letters out to homeowners who come out on the notice of default list, and in response I've gotten phone calls from citizens thanking me profusely for sending out those letters because they've had people calling them and showing up on their doorstep wanting to rescue them out of foreclosure. I can tell you that the first time I sent these letters out by myself, not having our secretary do it, was in March of 2007. I sent out 39 letters. Now I send out 160 every 2 weeks. So when people sit here and tell you that nothing is going wrong in the Portland, Oregon market, I beg to differ. How come I send out 4 times as many letters now than I did in March of 2007? There's clearly a problem. And I hope that this committee and or the legislature in general will do something to address it. I've heard people say that all you need to do is call your lender if you end up in foreclosure. I have yet to hear of a case where the lender works with the homeowner. I'm sure it happens. I just haven't heard of it. That was all I had to offer. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. And if you could
Please stay where you are, and we'll hear from the other witnesses on this panel, and then we'll open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, mortgage brokers in the state, and I have with me Todd Williams, a mortgage broker, who will offer additional testimony. I'm just going to be very brief and talk about a couple of issues, some of which you already heard, so I'm not going to spend much time. But as you've heard, this is a very complex issue, and one of the reasons the Mortgage Lending Work Group deferred this and was looking to the 2009 session to look at some of these issues was because of their complexity. We have been put in a position in the industry of being totally reactive this this legislative special session. I think Representative Thatcher raised the question, how much input have you had into what is being proposed here? And the answer is none. The industry has not been asked to sit around the table and come up with some of these suggestions that, that might improve lending practices in the state. Now, we think the Mortgage Lending Work Group is the perfect forum to do that, and hope we have an opportunity to continue to discuss these issues in that forum. Mr. Marquis talked about some of the statistics, and I think it's important to note, and I'm not going to say this is the only reason Oregon is doing very well, but one of them is actions that you took as a 2001 legislature in imposing some significant education requirements on loan originators, imposing testing of loan originators before they could begin working in the state. Those types of issues, I think, are serving us well at this point, and I think you're to be congratulated for that positive step you took in 2001. A specific part of the bill that I think you need to be aware of, and you've heard comments on this too, but it is the bonding section. Section 9, pages 10 and 11, where the lines are left blank. I caution you in putting the numbers in those lines. When the current bonding requirements were established, I think it was in the 1999 session, we had several meetings where everybody sat together and tried to come up with what would be, number one, the best number, and what the cost and impacts of those bonds would be. I have heard from what is in Senate Bill 1090, which is a $100,000 bond, that if that were enacted, there is a bonding company that will lose about half of its 300 clients because they could not the asset requirements that would be established there. So whatever number you put in, realize that you are risking putting legitimate Oregon businesses out of business and their employees as well. These are small companies. So I think I urge you to proceed with caution in that area. I'll let Mr. Williams talk specifically about some other parts of the bill.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. My name is Todd Williams. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
My name is Todd Williams. I am a mortgage broker and mortgage banker. I have been for nearly 20 years. I own a firm called Evergreen Ohana Mortgage Group, which, for the record, has nothing to do with the in the case that she addressed. I first want to take a moment and thank a couple of key people, predominantly Representatives Holvey and Bonamici, who have worked tirelessly with myself and a handful of other people on the governor's work group, and I also commend the governor for putting that group together. I work in an industry that has a lot of detail, a lot of regulation, a lot of very technical information, and small, what seem to be minuscule moves that we make in various legislation can have voluminous and catastrophic consequences when actually applied in our business. I also want to thank the police officer here for vigilantly helping us get rid of bad actors and bad players in our industry. They are the minority, but they exist, and I very much appreciate her efforts and the idea of contacting individuals who receive notices of default is a huge help. Our association, I am the chair of the Government Affairs Committee for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, and I'm also here representing that group today. We support mortgage reform. We support things like prepayment penalties and limitations on them, and properly structuring them such that they work as a benefit to the consumer and a workable situation for industry. The key piece associated with this individual piece of legislation is, as been represented several times, including with the police officer here, this is a pretty much more sweeping piece of legislation than you would give credence to, and it's been drafted and provided to us not even 24 hours before we're having a hearing on it. Like I said in the beginning of my testimony, one of the key problems when we deal with this is we as the industry literally have to go back to some of these large lenders and servicers and large financial institutions and title companies and so forth and say, as this gets applied in the state of Oregon, how will this affect the way you'll be able to provide good borrowing funds for our Oregon homeowners to operate under this statute? It takes time for that to happen. And a 28-day session and a few-hour-long committee does not provide us the ability to do that. The Mortgage Loan Work Group is the place to address those issues, and that's where we have done them. We made a commitment of 2.5 years of our time. I drive to Salem at least 3 days a week these days. I actually have a company that I run, and I write loans for a living every day, meeting Oregon consumers face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball. That's what I do for a living. That's a good group. It's doing good things, and I would hope that doing end-arounds with tweaking little pieces here and there is not what we're trying to accomplish through that. One of the key arguments that's been brought up about the need to do something now as opposed to working through the work group and the 09 session and not waiting for the feds to make their move, which clearly covers all loans, not just a portion of the loans in our state. One of the earlier questions that was asked to the DCBS was, what percentage of Oregon loans would this affect? And she's exactly right, depending on whose statistics you use, federally exempt institutions originate 40 to 60% of the loans in this state. So let's split the difference and call it half. That means whatever we do here only affects half of the loans in our state. To me, that's not good that's not good policy, not good legislation. Lobbyist Mr. Marquis from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association made an exact example of what I deal with every single day in my business, and that is I do the same thing that a loan officer for a federally chartered bank does, yet I'm held to a different standard. I have to do it differently. I have to provide different information and provide the same product, the same service, and the same function. Lastly, I'll conclude my testimony with the understanding that one of the reasons for this we need to do something now piece is subprime loans, option arm loans, loans with rate resets, and this impending gloom and doom. Understand a very important key feature to all of those loans, and that is the fact that they are all tied to interest rate indexes. And whether you agree with the Federal Reserve's and move to drop interest rates dramatically or not, the resulting function of that is a lot of the folks that have subprime loans and a lot of the folks that have option arm loans with rate resets coming up are not going to see the dramatic, draconian, sky is falling kind of adjustments that have been touted in the media day after day after day. I'd be happy to chat with anybody afterwards and walk through specific mathematical examples of that, but I won't bore you with that at this time. That will conclude my testimony. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, thank you for being here. So I actually wanted to start out by asking the detective about how the cases that you get come your way. How do you get... I know that you're sending these letters out now, but obviously you've got quite a caseload. It sounds like in addition to sending letters notifying people that you're available. So,
The first one came about quite by accident. An elderly lady had complained of having been the victim of a forgery committed by her son. And in the course of just interviewing her over the phone, she explained to me that she conducted a real estate transaction in 2006, I believe, or 2004, in which she had given her house away for $40,000 to a loan originator who got her name because she came out on the notice of default list. Ultimately, that case resolved itself civilly as far as the criminal piece goes because the statute of limitations expired. So since that case is resolved, I'm still not going to mention any names because the person hasn't been convicted. In the second case that I have been working on, which is this one, this lady's name came to my attention through Multnomah County Aging Services. If I might, Madam Chair, I would like to offer some suggestions for solutions to these problems, since rather than sitting here and just strictly complaining. The state of Washington passed some legislation known as the Washington Mortgage Broker Practices Act a couple of years ago. It's very good legislation, and what it does is for every escrow closing, $1 is paid into a fund administered by the state, and that pays for a prosecutor and an investigator to exclusively work on real estate fraud-related cases. I might suggest that maybe if you are interested taking a look at that legislation, it also requires criminal background checks of loan originators, and if they are convicted of a felony, they are not allowed to be licensed in the state of Washington as of January 1st of this year.
Okay, those are great suggestions. We actually have another committee, and in fact, some of the members of our committee are on it, that is about to convene here. So I'm going to have to just limit questions. Is there anybody who is desperately in need of asking a question? Okay. Well, thank you very much, all of you, for being here. And if you've got written testimony, please feel free to submit it. I apologize to the other people who signed up and those who didn't sign up who want to testify, but we are, frankly, out of time. Members, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3603. And, members, we are meeting tomorrow morning again at 8 o'clock. We are also meeting tomorrow afternoon at 5:15, and I think because this week is going to be a very hectic week, I'll just have to ask you to make sure that we can stay in close touch with you. We will attempt to get you information about what we're doing and amendments as quickly as we get them, so no one will be taken by surprise. And, oh, I see you're writing. I thought you were writing me in there.
I'm writing the time. I'm writing the time.
8 o'clock. And so, I guess we recess.
So close.
So I need to, I close this public hearing.
Okay.
And then on House Bill 3624. Okay, so I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3624. And with nothing further to come before us this morning, committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.